Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, October 16, 2023. This Tuesday, October 17, 2023. The United Nations World Food Programme says the conflict in Sudan has resulted into a humanitarian crisis in South Sudan.
When they cross the border, they have absolutely nothing with them. We're finding that a lot of people are malnourished. We've done some screening at the border that found that almost 20% of children under five and more than a quarter of pregnant and breastfeeding mothers who are crossing the border malnourished.
And the International Committee of the Red Cross says its staff will continue to offer services to residents trapped in Khartoum and other cities in Sudan.
In spite of challenges such as limited access to these in need, the ICRC remains committed by itself to support this, the Sudanese people through their operation in the country. The ICRC, along with Sudanese Red Crescent Society, we are working together in the ground.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on this Tuesday, October 17, 2023. The United Nations World Food Programme says funding gaps, influx of refugees and returnees from Sudan could result into record levels of hunger in South Sudan. The UN says people forcibly displaced from their homes in Sudan have fled to neighbouring South Sudan, where host communities are struggling to survive. Gemma Snowdon, WFP spokesperson in South Sudan, says the situation could become worse with the onset of rainy season in the country.
So as of today, more than 315,000 people have crossed from Sudan into South Sudan as they're fleeing the fighting in Sudan. Most of those people who are crossing the border, almost 90% of them are South Sudanese returnees and the rest are mostly refugees. And the people who are arriving now at this stage of the conflict in Sudan, they're extremely vulnerable. I mean, they've diminished all of their resources that they have, all of their coping strategies. They've traveled an extremely long way, often on foot. Maybe they've faced robberies or other issues along the way. When they cross the border, they have absolutely nothing with them. We're finding that a lot of people are malnourished. We've done some screening at the border that found that almost 20% of children under five and more than a quarter of pregnant and breastfeeding mothers who are crossing the border malnourished. And on top of that, 90% of the returnee families who have come across the border experiencing moderate or severe food insecurity. So the situation is dramatic, to say the least. People are facing extreme forms of hunger. And the simple fact is that humanitarian needs over the past few years, but this year particularly, have just been outpacing the resources that we've been receiving. So we have had to prioritize assistance. At the moment, we are providing assistance to returnees in the form of cash or food distributions, as well as high energy biscuits and nutrition prevention and treatment programs. But it's just not enough. We absolutely need more resources to keep up with the needs that we're seeing.
Talking about resources, and the government of South Sudan, through its Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs, had announced that they were donating close to, you know, $10 million to help UN with integrating and settling down the returnees. Could you speak to that effect? I mean, it's a local initiative that needs to be recognized.
I mean, I'm not across the exact details of that funding, but I do know that the government has been supportive, particularly one of the major challenges that humanitarian agencies are having is moving people on, particularly from the border crossing up in Renk in Upper Nile, because that's where the majority of people are crossing the border. So the transit centre there is congested and overcrowded, and one of the big challenges has been moving people on, which the government has been very supportive with. But particularly now coming out of the rainy season, that transit center has experienced flooding. There were multiple instances of flooding over the past month, which just leaves conditions ripe for the spread of disease. So these are just some of the challenges that we're facing, and it's imperative that we're able to move people on to locations that are better equipped to meet humanitarian needs. I mean, as you and many of your listeners probably know, Renk has traditionally been one of the most food secure parts of South Sudan. And due to its ability to grow food, but also because of its proximity to Sudan. So there hasn't been a major humanitarian presence there. I mean, for WFP, for example, it's been more of a logistics base, moving food into the country. So the quicker we can move people on to areas where there is more of a humanitarian setup, the better it will be in terms of the response.
How about the host communities in South Sudan? I mean, WFP has been operating in South Sudan for quite a long time, helping vulnerable communities with much-needed food supplies. In the backdrop of this influx of returnees, how is the situation of the host communities? I mean, they also need help.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, South Sudan is facing one of its most food insecure and hungriest years ever. There's been a toxic combination of the climate crisis as well as ongoing conflict and then these enormous rises in food and fuel prices across the country. It's just putting food out of reach for families who have previously been able to feed themselves. I mean, a lot of the families that I've spoken to this year and heard from have said that they're receiving food assistance for the first time. We have a really unique situation here in South Sudan where parts of the country are facing drought, while other parts, like up in Bentu, Unity State, they've been underwater for almost four consecutive years, and that's just a complete loss of arable land, pasture land. It means that families have lost all of their livelihoods, and they have no way of rebuilding.
Could you talk about some coping mechanisms that the UN is looking at to ensure that these vulnerable communities are not donor dependent forever?
World Food Programme works with farmers and communities to adapt to different shocks that they experience, whether that's conflict or climate or high food and fuel prices, so that they can become more independent, more resilient. That definitely includes things like climate-friendly agriculture, helping communities build shared assets, such as we have shallow wells, which are built in communities that experience prolonged dry spells. So even during the dry spells, they still have water that they can use for their gardens, for their livestock, etc. So these resilience activities and coping activities are incredibly important going forward, because it is the only way that communities are going to be able to support themselves in the face of these funding shortfalls, as WFP has to prioritize the humanitarian assistance.
That's Gemma Snowden, WFP spokesperson in South Sudan. She spoke with me from Juba earlier today. South Sudan's senior government officials say the country is facing hurdles in replacing personnel in various security agencies. The country's interior minister says the government is ready to recuperate its workforce by employing younger people, but lacks money for paying retirees. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
Addressing senior police officers in Juba Monday, South Sudan's Minister of Interior, Angelina Teny, says the government is ready to employ younger people in the security agencies, but faces funding hiccups. She says some aged government employees are unwilling to retire.
You cannot keep people in an institution for their entire lives, of course. There is an entry and an exit. And for you to employ young blood, because the organized forces work is meant for young people. The elderly people stay in offices, but the work in the streets and anywhere is done by young people. If you don't exit, it becomes difficult for you to continue to recruit. It will bring problems.
Teny says despite having a retirement policy in place, implementing some of its provisions remains an uphill task. She says the government does not have sufficient funds to pay pensions to employees who have reached retirement age.
Even in the field of gratuity, its laws are ready. The challenge is the employees' contributions are collected, and the challenge is the contribution coming from the Ministry of Finance, which is bigger than individual contributions. So if you decide to roll out pensions that are coming from the field of gratuity, maybe you would pay for 2 months or 3 months, and then you would run into problems.
She says she believes the challenges can be addressed, adding that she will continue to pressure the Ministry of Finance to contribute cash towards the pension scheme. Agok Makur is South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Finance and Economic Planning. He says the government is ready to contribute money into the pension arrangement.
Pension of soldiers is there. This arrangement is there. It's deducted to pension. It's deducted already. This money is going to that commission. And even the arrangement of civil servant is there also for signing pension.
In 2019, South Sudan's Ministry of Labor, Public Service and Human Resource Development paid pensions to some former government civil servants on a retirement list. South Sudan's former Minister of Labor said the pension fund would allow long-serving civil servants to exit so that the government can employ more employees in its civil service. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where the International Committee of the Red Cross reports that 6 months into the armed conflict between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has caused extensive humanitarian needs, and most of the needs remain unfulfilled. ICRC spokesperson for Sudan, Adnan Hezam, told my colleague Nabil Biagio that the humanitarian efforts are hindered by difficulties in reaching millions of people affected by the conflict amid shortages of essential services like shelter, water, food and medicine.
Sudan is facing devastating humanitarian crisis with a larger scale of mass displacement, severe shortage of resources, including food, water, medicines and fuel. We could say the ongoing fighting had led to the increasing struggling of the people of Sudan, with their needs growing every day. The escalation, and maybe this escalation of violence, would only worsen the situation, not just for Sudan, but also for the neighboring countries. Now we are talking over 5.3 million people displaced, either inside the country or seek asylum in the neighboring country. While some inside the country, while some found in temporary refugee with a family or friends, many others remain in displaced shelters or camps or makeshift settlements. So this is the situation of most of, let's say, one of the consequences of this humanitarian tragedy, that there is a huge number of displaced people. Months of fighting have left vital services in the country fragile, especially the water sector and also health sector, making it difficult for the population to have access to these essential services like safe water and healthcare. So this ongoing fighting also affected the healthcare facilities. Yeah. We could say there is like in Khartoum, I think just 20% of health facilities still functioning, which is reflecting also the situation of the whole health system in the country. It is affected a lot. There is like a shortage of medication, surgical supplies. Even with the staff, there is a shortage in the staff.
And you, ICRC did mention the statement you guys put out that access to people affected by the conflict has been difficult in Sudan because of the fighting. And my question is, given the difficult access and decreased humanitarian funding, how is the ICRC planning to increase its assistance to the affected populations in Sudan?
Despite of challenges such as limited access to these in need, the ICRC remains committed by itself to support this, the Sudanese people through their operation in the country. The ICRC, along with Sudanese Red Crescent Society, we are working together in the ground, tireless to assess the humanitarian situation and provide assistance to respond to the emergencies especially if you remember at the beginning of the conflict, it's like a frontline operations to the, for people who want to be out of the conflict zone by providing critical services, like life-saving activities, first aid. We're supporting to Sudan Red Crescent by providing with the first aid kits to help the injured people and to provide the healthcare for the injuries at the beginning of the conflict. So the ICRC, from the first hour of the conflict in the ground, through their staff and also the National Society, the Sudan Red Crescent, together to try to do their best to provide what they can provide to elevate and suffer at that stage. Now we're trying through our dialogue with the parties involved in the conflict to have access to these people who need. Okay, it might be take long, but at the end we managed to have some operation in the ground, evacuating this orphanage, orphans.
Are the warring parties like, cooperating with you, the army and the RSF? Are they cooperating, delivery of aid?
Look, as ICRC, we have this bilateral dialogue with this party to the conflict to, first of all, to have acceptance for the ICRC and also to have access for us and our team and give a security guarantee for our team to be in the ground. I could say there is like a cooperation, but we ask for more, especially now we're talking about there is like more than 20 million Sudanese. They are need assistance in different way, water, food, shelter. So with this mechanism of a dialogue, we try to have access to these people affected by this conflict and provide what we can provide.
And there are vulnerable communities in border areas of neighboring countries, not just in Sudan, people who are sharing their limited resources with the refugees. I'm thinking, for example, in Rank in South Sudan, the border point, but also places like Adre in eastern Chad. Could you elaborate on the support and assistance the ICRC is providing to these communities and how their situation is being addressed?
For example, in Chad, we deployed a surgical team at the beginning of the conflict to provide their healthcare services and surgical services to the refugees in Adri. Plus, we have our family reunion we did like a, what you call it, RFL reunion family link, which we do our team be in the spot with the Chad Red Cross and also Sudan Red Cross and inside the country to receive requests of missing relatives. So we try to make a link between people who displaced or refugees, between their family who missed or they want to reunion their contact. So this is two interventions from our side.
Do you do that both in Chad and in South Sudan, or only?
We do. Because it's for this project of RFL. So it's also to cooperate with the national society, like a Chad Red Cross and also Sudan Red Crescent. They receive a request from family who missed the relative, and they want to looking for it for him or her. So we help in that. Also, we established like a call center to receive a call from, but this is inside Sudan. So we received the call of people who are looking for their missing relatives.
That's Adnan Hizam, ICRC spokesperson for Sudan. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, U.S. President Joe Biden heads to Israel. Find out why after the break.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced that President Joe Biden will head to Israel Wednesday in a rare wartime visit just hours after Blinken had to seek shelter from Hamas rocket attacks during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
After 7.5 hours of negotiations into the early morning hours Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken persuaded Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to develop a plan to enable humanitarian aid from donor nations and multilateral organizations to reach civilians in Gaza, including the possibility of creating areas to help civilians stay out of harm's way. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Still on the Middle East crisis, the International Committee of the Red Cross is pressuring Hamas to give it access to at least 199 Israeli hostages that its militants kidnapped more than a week ago. From Tel Aviv, Israel, Linda Greystein reports on how hundreds of Israeli civilians have set up a war room in a desperate effort to find the hostages.
For families and friends, a wall of heartbreak. The faces of some of the 199 or more civilians kidnapped and taken into Gaza hang outside Israel's Defense Ministry headquarters as a reminder they're still missing. Among the kidnapped are young children and older adults. The families of the hostages have banded together to pressure the government to bring their relatives home.
They took his wife, my aunt, Adina Moshe, 70 years old. She's sick. They took it out of the windows. And then we didn't know what happened to her until hours later. We get from many people that show us the movie that see her between two terrorists, cruel terrorists who kill her husband, and they took her on a motorcycle to Gaza Strip.
The families say that for more than a week, no representative for the government has met with them. But private Israelis sprang into action. They call it the War Room for the Missing, and they opened it at the Tel Aviv Expo Center. Here, hundreds of volunteers look online for any shred of evidence about the fate of the hostages. Until the war started, many were members of a group called Brothers in Arms, one of the organizations behind 9 months of mass protests against the Israeli government's planned judicial overhaul. Now the group has turned its attention to finding the hostages.
Israeli citizens from all kind of different sectors, from technology, from interrogation, from intelligence, from social networks, are gathered here to try to create a full image of what's going on.
Nahon, an information systems professor at Reichman University, says information they've gathered leads them to believe that more than 100 of the hostages are still alive. She sends the information found by her volunteers to the Israeli security services.
We found a lot of information about people in social media. In some cases, we understand that they were murdered, and then it's our job to update that we got new data. In other cases, we see that they're alive, and we see them write online that they survived the event and what they're doing at the moment. And in other cases, we bring it to further research if we don't have enough data.
He says the public's response makes him proud of his country. Citizens have supplied food to soldiers, helped tens of thousands of Israelis displaced from their homes near Gaza, and provided psychological help for those dealing with trauma.
When you see people just gather around and do whatever needs to be done at the moment to be strong and to win this situation, for me, this is my greatest source for being optimistic.
Israel is poised for a ground invasion of Gaza, but many Israelis say that getting the hostages back is their first priority. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Tel Aviv.
European Union heads of state will hold an emergency meeting Tuesday on the conflict between Israeli forces and Palestinian militants in Gaza following the cross-border attack by Hamas gunmen that killed at least 1,400 Israelis. As Henry Ridgewell reports, around 2,750 Palestinian civilians have been killed, and the mounting death toll has exposed divisions in the European response.
There are growing fears in Europe that the conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza will be felt beyond the Middle East. The European Union has called an emergency heads of state conference to be held Tuesday. European Council President Charles Michel.
It has the potential to worsen tensions between communities and to feed extremism. Finally, there is a major risk of migration and movements of a large number of people to neighboring countries.
European nations gave Israel their full support in the days following the Hamas attacks. But critics say there has been mixed messaging from EU leaders as the Israeli assault on Gaza intensifies. Visiting the Kfar Aza kibbutz Friday in southern Israel, where Hamas killed dozens of civilians, EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen offered unequivocal support.
Israel has the right to defend itself. In fact, it has the duty to defend its people.
Following that speech, the chair of the European Parliament's Security and Defence Subcommittee, Nathalie Loiseau, wrote that von der Leyen was forgetting an important message. Israel must respect international humanitarian law. Meanwhile, the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said last week Israel's siege of Gaza is against international law. The political narrative is becoming more nuanced, says Middle East analyst Andreas Krieg.
I think we're already seeing some of the Western policymakers backtracking and trying to put things into context and saying, while we stand with Israel, we also have to make sure that the lives of Palestinian civilians have to be secured and protected.
That view is echoed in European public opinion, says analyst Andreas Bohm.
They do have solidarity for Israel, I think, due to the nature of the attack. But if you go on a long run, if we see these pictures of, say, thousands or ten thousands of people killed in Gaza, so that might change again.
Israel is unlikely to change course, says Krieg.
And I think the Israelis also will be more resilient in sustaining criticism and sustaining also the leverage of Western policymakers, because they're saying this is our war, look at these atrocities, and we'll do whatever is necessary to eradicate Hamas.
Meanwhile, the European Union's Executive Commission has announced a tripling of humanitarian assistance to Gaza to $79 million US dollars. With Israel maintaining a complete siege of the territory, it isn't clear how or when the aid might reach those in need. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, October 17, 2023. We now leave you with a South Sudanese musician, Mawa, and the song Mama.
Yeah. This song is a special dedication to all the mothers out there, as a sign of appreciation, as a sign of love. Mawa, Mwana Minga. Shanita biligo, iya haja itader, shalakan haja al, ana mabiyak der, ashanita taban waratai, minana suker, itageni hanisana kanana gikore, katiana mimotoro, kaman sekete, itageni kore kore kanana gijere jere, ashankede ana mawaka auku kisi, kanana.
We've been listening to Mawa and the song Ya Mama. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Shala fisika ashan yomtani uwa bitala umazaita ubirudu iyalto kama benefsa teriga.